many affectionate remembrances to your dear Eugenie. And with best love to her and yourself, I remain ever yours truly, Eloise de Villefort. P.S. Do pray contrive some means for my meeting the Count of Monte Cristo at your house. I must and will see him again. I have just made Monsieur de Villefort promise to call on him in order to acknowledge the signal service he has rendered our family in preserving our child. If my unworthy self goes for nothing, and I flatter myself my husband's visit will be returned by the Count. Nothing was talked of throughout the evening but the adventure at Auteuil. Albert related it to his mother, Château Renaud recounted it at the Jockey Club, and Debray detailed it at length in the salons of the minister. Even Beauchamp accorded 20 lines in his journal to the relation of the Count's courage and gallantry, thereby placing him as the greatest hero of the day before the eyes of all the fair members of the aristocracy of France. Vast was the crowd of visitors and inquiring friends who left their names at the hotel of Madame de Villefort, with the design of renewing their visit at the right moment, of hearing from her lips all the interesting circumstances of this most romantic adventure. As Eloise had stated, Monsieur de Villefort donned his best black suit, drew on a pair of new white kid gloves, ordered the servants to attend the carriage dressed in their full livery, and forthwith drove to the hotel of the Count, situated, as the reader is already informed, in the Avenue des Champs-Élysées. 49. Ideology. If the Count of Monte Cristo had lived for a very long time in Parisian society, he would have fully appreciated the value of the step which Monsieur de Villefort had taken. Standing well at court, whether the King Regnant was of the elder or younger branch, whether the government was doctrinaire, liberal, or conservative, esteemed clever by all, just as we generally esteem those clever who have never experienced a political check. Hated by many, but warmly protected by others, without being really liked by anybody, Monsieur de Villefort held a high position in the magistracy, and maintained his eminence like a Harley or a Merle. His drawing-room, regenerated by a young wife and a daughter by his first marriage, scarcely 18, was still one of those well-regulated Paris salons where the worship of traditional customs and the observance of rigid etiquette were carefully maintained. A freezing politeness, a strict fidelity to government principles, a profound contempt for theories and theorists, a deep-seated hatred of ideality, these were the elements of private and public life displayed by Monsieur de Villefort. Monsieur de Villefort was not only a magistrate, he was also a diplomatist. His relations with the ancient court, of which he always spoke with dignity and respect, made him respected by the new one, and he knew so many things that not only was he always carefully considered, but sometimes consulted. Perhaps this would not have been so, had it been possible to get rid of Monsieur de Villefort, but, like the feudal barons who rebelled against their sovereign, he dwelt in an impregnable fortress. This fortress was his post as Procureur du Roi, all the advantages of which he worked out marvellously, and which he would not have resigned but to be made deputy, and thus have converted neutrality into opposition. Monsieur de Villefort made and returned very few visits. For his friends, Monsieur de Villefort was a powerful protector. For his enemies, he was a silent but bitter enemy. For those who were neither the one nor the other, he was a statue of the law-made man. Haughty air, immovable countenance, look steady and impenetrable, or else insultingly piercing and inquiring, such was the man for whom four revolutions, skilfully piled one on the other, had first constructed and afterwards cemented the pedestal on which his fortune was elevated. Monsieur de Villefort had the reputation of being the least curious and least wearisome man in France. He gave a ball every year, at which he appeared for a quarter of an hour only, that is to say, 45 minutes less than the king is visible at his balls. He was never seen at the theatres, at concerts, or in any place of public resort. Occasionally, but seldom, he played at whist, and then care was taken to select partners worthy of him. Sometimes they were ambassadors, sometimes archbishops, or sometimes a prince or a president, or some dowager duchess. Such was the man whose carriage had just now stopped before the Count of Monte Cristo's door. The valet de chambre announced Monsieur de Villefort at the moment when the Count, leaning over a large table, was tracing on a map the route from St. Petersburg to China. The procureur du roi entered with the same grave and measured step he would have employed in entering a court of justice. He was the same man, or rather the completion of the same man, whom we have heretofore seen as substitut at Marseille. Nature, following up its principles, had changed nothing for him in the course he had chalked out for himself. From slender, he had become meagre, from pale, yellow. His deep-set eyes were now hollow, and gold spectacles, as they shielded his eyes, seemed to make a portion of his face. All his costume was black, with the exception of his white cravat, and this funereal appearance was only broken in upon by the slight line of red riband which passed almost imperceptibly through his buttonhole, and which appeared like a streak of blood traced with a pencil. Although master of himself, Monte Cristo scrutinized with irrepressible curiosity the magistrate whose salute he returned, and who, distrustful by habit and especially incredulous as to social marvels, was much more disposed to see in the noble stranger, as Monte Cristo was already called, a chevalier d'industrie who had come to try new ground, or some malefactor who had broken his prescribed limits, than a prince of the Holy See or a sultan of the Arabian Nights. "Sir," said Villefort, in the tone assumed by magistrates in their oratorical periods, and of which they cannot or will not divest themselves in society, "Sir, the signal service which you yesterday rendered to my wife and son has made it a duty in me to offer you my thanks. Allow me, therefore, to discharge this duty and express to you all my gratitude." And as he said this, the eye severe of the magistrate had lost nothing of its habitual arrogance. These words he articulated in the voice of a procureur général, with the rigid inflexibility of neck and shoulders, which caused his flatterers to say, as we have said before, that he was the living statue of the law. "Monsieur," replied the Count, with a chilling air, "I am very happy to have been the means of preserving a son to his mother, for they say that the sentiment of maternity is the most holy of all, and the good fortune which occurred to me, monsieur, might have enabled you to dispense with a duty which, in its discharge, confers an undoubtedly great honour. For I am aware that Monsieur de Villefort is not lavish of the favour he bestows on me, but which, however estimable, is unequal to the satisfaction which I internally experience." Villefort, astonished at this reply, which he by no means expected, started like a soldier who feels the blow levelled at him over the armour he wears, and a curl of his disdainful lip indicated that from that moment he noted in the tablets of his brain that the Count of Monte Cristo was by no means a highly bred gentleman. He glanced round in order to seize on something on which the conversation might turn, and seemed to fall easily. He saw the map which Monte Cristo had been examining when he entered, and said, "You seem geographically engaged, sir. It is a rich study for you who, as I learn, have seen as many lands as are delineated on this map." "Yes, sir," replied the Count. "I have sought to make on the human race, taken as a mass, what you practice every day on individuals, a physiological study. I have believed it was much easier to descend from the whole to a part than to ascend from a part to the whole. It is an algebraic axiom which makes us proceed from a known to an unknown quantity, and not from an unknown to a known. But sit down, sir, I beg of you." Monte Cristo pointed to a chair which the procureur du roi was obliged to take the trouble to move forwards himself, whilst the Count merely fell back into his own, on which he had been kneeling when Monsieur Villefort entered. Thus the Count was halfway turned towards his visitor, having his back towards the window, his elbow resting on the geographical chart, which afforded the conversation for the moment, a conversation which assumed, as had done those with Danglars and Morcerf, a turn analogous to the persons, if not to the situation.
"Ah, you philosophize," replied Villefort, after a moment's silence, during which, like a wrestler who encounters a powerful opponent, he took breath. "Well, sir, really, if, like you, I had nothing else to do, I should seek a more amusing occupation."
"Why, in truth, sir," was Monte Cristo's reply,
man is but an ugly caterpillar for him who studies him through a solar microscope. But you said, I think, that I had nothing else to do. Now really, let me ask, sir, have you? Do you believe you have anything to do? Or, to speak in plain terms, do you really think that what you do deserves being called anything?
Vifor's astonishment redoubled at this second thrust, so forcibly made by his strange adversary. It was a long time since the magistrate had heard a paradox so strong, or rather, to say the truth more exactly, it was the first time he had ever heard it. The procureur du roi exerted himself to reply.
"Sir," he responded, "you are a stranger, and I believe you say yourself that a portion of your life has been spent in Oriental countries. Thus, then, you are not aware how human justice, so expeditious in barbarous countries, takes with us a prudent and well-studied course. Oh, yes. Yes, I do, sir. It is the pede claudo of the ancients. I know all that, for it is with the justice of all countries especially that I have occupied myself. It is with the criminal procedure of all nations that I have compared natural justice. And I must say, sir, that it is the law of primitive nations, that is, the law of retaliation, that I have most frequently found to be according to the law of God."
"If this law were adopted, sir," said the procureur du roi, "it would greatly simplify our legal codes, and in that case the magistrates would not, as you have just observed, have much to do."
"It may perhaps come to this in time," observed Monte Cristo. "You know that human inventions march from the complex to the simple, and simplicity is always perfection."
"In the meanwhile," continued the magistrate, "our codes are in full force with all their contradictory enactments derived from Gallic customs, Roman laws, and Frank usages, the knowledge of all which, you will agree, is not to be acquired without lengthened labour, and it requires a tedious study to acquire this knowledge, and when that is acquired, a strong power of brain is necessary in order to retain it."
"I agree with you entirely, sir. But all that even you know with respect to the French code, I know not only in reference to that code, but as regards the codes of all nations. The English, Turkish, Japanese, Hindu laws are as familiar to me as the French laws, and thus I was right when I said to you that relatively, you know that everything is relative, sir, that relatively to what I have done, you have very little to do, but that relatively to all I have learned, you have yet a great deal to learn."
"But with what motive have you learned all this?" inquired Vifor, astonished.
Monte Cristo smiled. "Really, sir," he observed, "I see that in spite of the reputation which you have acquired as a superior man, you contemplate everything in the material and vulgar view of society, beginning with man and ending with man, that is to say, in the most restricted, most narrow view which it is possible for human understanding to embrace. Pray, sir, explain yourself," said Vifor, more and more astonished.
"I really do not understand you perfectly."
"I say, sir, that with the eyes fixed on the social organization of nations, you see only the springs of the machine and lose sight of the sublime workman who makes them act. I say that you do not recognize before you and around you any but those placemen whose brevets have been signed by the minister or the king, and that the men whom God has put above those titulars, ministers and kings, by giving them a mission to follow out instead of a post to fill, I say that they escape your narrow, limited ken. It is thus that human weakness fails from its debilitated and imperfect organs. Tobias took the angel who restored him to light for an ordinary young man. The nations took Attila, who was doomed to destroy them, for a conqueror merely similar to other conquerors, and it was necessary for both to reveal their missions that they might be known and acknowledged. One was compelled to say, 'I am the angel of the Lord,' and the other, 'I am the hammer of God,' in order that the divine essence in both might be revealed."
"Then," said Vifor, more and more amazed, and really supposing he was speaking to a mystic or a madman, "you consider yourself as one of those extraordinary beings whom you have mentioned."
"And why not?" said Monte Cristo coldly.
"Your pardon, sir," replied Vifor, quite astounded, "but you will excuse me if, when I presented myself to you, I was unaware that I should meet with a person whose knowledge and understanding so far surpass the usual knowledge and understanding of men.
It is not usual with us, corrupted wretches of civilization, to find gentlemen like yourself, possessors as you are of immense fortune, at least so it is said, and I beg you to observe that I do not inquire, I merely repeat, it is not usual, I say, for such privileged and wealthy beings to waste their time in speculations on the state of society, in philosophical reveries, intended at best to console those whom fate has disinherited from the goods of this world. Really, sir? Retorted the Count. Have you attained the eminent situation in which you are, without having admitted or even without having met with exceptions? And do you never use your eyes, which must have acquired so much finesse and certainty, to divine at a glance the kind of man who has come before you? Should not a magistrate be not merely the best administrator of the law, but the most crafty expounder of the chicanery of his profession, a steel probe to search hearts, a touchstone to try the gold which in each soul is mingled with more or less of alloy? Sir, said Vifor, upon my word you overcome me. I really never heard a person speak as you do, because you remain eternally encircled in a round of general conditions, and have never dared to raise your wing into those upper spheres which God has peopled with invisible or marked beings. And you allow then, sir, that spheres exist, and that these marked and invisible beings mingle amongst us. Why should they not? Can you see the air you breathe, and yet without which you could not for a moment exist? Then we do not see those beings to whom you allude. Yes, we do. You see them whenever God pleases to allow them to assume a material form. You touch them, come in contact with them, speak to them, and they reply to you. Ah, said Vifor, smiling. I confess I should like to be warned when one of these beings is in contact with me. You have been served as you desire, monsieur, for you have been warned just now, and I now again warn you. Then you yourself are one of these marked beings? Yes, monsieur, I believe so. For until now, no man has found himself in a position similar to mine. The dominions of kings are limited either by mountains or rivers or a change of manners or an alteration of language. My kingdom is bounded only by the world, for I am neither an Italian, nor a Frenchman, nor a Hindu, nor an American, nor a Spaniard. I am a cosmopolite. No country can say it saw my birth. God alone knows what country will see me die. I adopt all customs, speak all languages. You believe me to be a Frenchman, for I speak French with the same facility and purity as yourself. Well, Ali, my Nubian, believes me to be an Arab. Bertuccio, my steward, takes me for a Roman. Ede, my slave, thinks me a Greek. You may therefore comprehend that being of no country, asking no protection from any government, acknowledging no man as my brother, not one of the scruples that arrest the powerful or the obstacles which paralyze the weak, paralyze or arrest me. I have only two adversaries. I will not say two conquerors, for with perseverance I subdue even them, though they are time and distance. There is a third, and the most terrible. That is my condition as a mortal being. This alone can stop me in my onward career, and before I have attained the goal at which I aim. For all the rest I have calculated. What men call the chances of fate, namely ruin, change, circumstances, I have anticipated them all, and if any of these should overtake me, yet they will not overwhelm me. Unless I die, I shall always be what I am, and therefore it is that I utter the things you have never heard, even from the mouths of kings, for kings have need, and other persons have fear of you. For who is there who does not say to himself, in society as incongruously organized as ours, perhaps some day I shall have to do with the procureur du roi? But can you not say that, sir? For the moment you become an inhabitant of France, you are naturally subjected to the French laws. I know it, sir, replied Monte Cristo. But when I visit a country, I begin to study by all the means which are available the men from whom I may have anything to hope or to fear, until I know them as well, perhaps better, than they know themselves. It follows from this that the procureur du roi, be he who he may, with whom I should have to deal, would assuredly be more embarrassed than I should. That is to say, replied Vifor with hesitation, that human nature being weak, every man, according to your creed, has committed faults.
Faults or crimes, responded Monte Cristo, with a negligent air,
and that you alone, amongst the men whom you do not recognize as your brothers, for you have said so, observed Vifor, in a tone that faltered somewhat, you alone are perfect.
No, not perfect, was the Count's reply, only impenetrable, that's all.
But let us leave off this strain, sir, if the tone of it is displeasing to you. I am no more disturbed by your justice than you are by my second sight.
No, no, by no means, said Vifor, who was afraid of seeming to abandon his ground.
No, by your brilliant and almost sublime conversation you have elevated me above the ordinary level. We no longer talk, we rise to dissertation. But you know how the theologians in their collegiate chairs and philosophers in their controversies occasionally say cruel truths. Let us suppose for the moment that we are theologizing in a social way or even philosophically, and I will say to you, rude as it may seem, my brother, you sacrifice greatly to pride. You may be above others, but above you there is God.
Above us all, sir, was Monte Cristo's response, in a tone and with an emphasis so deep that Vifor involuntarily shuddered.
I have my pride for men, serpents always ready to erect themselves against everyone who may pass without crushing them. But I lay aside that pride before God, who has taken me from nothing to make me what I am.
Then, Monsieur le Comte, I admire you, said Vifor, who, for the first time in this strange conversation, used the aristocratical form to the unknown personage whom, until now, he had only called Monsieur.
Yes, and I say to you, if you are really strong, really superior, really pious or impenetrable, which you were right in saying amounts to the same thing, yet be proud, sir. That is the characteristic of predominance. Yet you have unquestionably some ambition.
I have, sir.
And what may it be?
I too, as happens to every man once in his life, have been taken by Satan into the highest mountain in the earth, and when there he showed me all the kingdoms of the earth, and as he said before, so said he to me, Child of earth, what wouldst thou have to make thee adore me? I reflected long, for a gnawing ambition had long preyed upon me, and then I replied, Listen, I have always heard tell of Providence, and yet I have never seen him, nor anything that resembles him, or which can make me believe that he exists. I wish to be Providence myself, for I feel that the most beautiful, noblest, most sublime thing in the world is to recompense and punish. Satan bowed his head and groaned. You mistake, he said. Providence does exist, only you have never seen him, because the child of God is as invisible as the parent. You have seen nothing that resembles him, because he works by secret springs and moves by hidden ways. All I can do for you is to make you one of the agents of that providence. The bargain was concluded. I may sacrifice my soul, but what matters it? Added Monte Cristo. If the thing were to do again, I would again do it.
Vifor looked at Monte Cristo with extreme amazement.
Monsieur le Comte, he inquired, have you any relations?
No, sir. I am alone in the world.
So much the worse.
Why? Asked Monte Cristo. Because then you might witness a spectacle calculated to break down your pride.
You say you fear nothing but death?
I did not say that I feared it. I only said that that alone could check me.
And old age?
My end will be achieved before I grow old.
And madness?
I have been nearly mad. And you know the axiom, non bis in idem. It is an axiom of criminal law, and consequently you understand its full application.
Sir, continued Vifor,
there is something to fear besides death, old age, and madness. For instance, there is apoplexy, that lightning stroke which strikes but does not destroy you, and yet after which all is ended. You are still yourself as now, and yet you are yourself no longer. You who, like Ariel, touch on the angelic, are but an inert mass which, like Caliban, touches on the brutal. And this is called in human tongue, as I tell you, neither more nor less than apoplexy. Come, if you so will, Monsieur Lecomte, and continue this conversation at my house any day you may be willing to see an adversary capable of understanding and anxious to refute you, and I will show you my father, Monsieur Noirtier de Villefort, one of the most fiery Jacobins of the French Revolution, that is to say, the most remarkable audacity, seconded by a most powerful organization, a man who perhaps has not, like yourself, seen all the kingdoms of the earth, but who has helped to overturn one of the most powerful. In fact, a man who, like you, believed himself one of the envoys not of God, but of a supreme being, not of providence, but of fate. Well, sir, the rupture of a blood vessel on a lobe of the brain has destroyed all this, not in a day, not in an hour, but in a second. Monsieur Noirtier, who on the previous night was the old Jacobin, the old senator, the old Carbonaro, laughing at the guillotine, laughing at the cannon, laughing at the dagger, Monsieur Noirtier playing with revolutions, Monsieur Noirtier, for whom France was a vast chessboard, from which pawns, rooks, knights, and queens were to disappear, so that the king was checkmated. Monsieur Noirtier, so redoubted, was the next morning, poor Monsieur Noirtier, the helpless old man at the tender mercies of the weakest creature in the household, that is, his grandchild, Valentine. A dumb and frozen carcass, in fact, who only lives without suffering, that time may be given to his frame to decompose without his consciousness of his decay.
Alas, sir, said Monte Cristo, this spectacle is neither strange to my eye nor my thought. I am something of a physician, and have, like my fellows, sought more than once for the soul in living and in dead matter. Yet, like Providence, it has remained invisible to my eyes, although present to my heart. 100 writers since Socrates, Seneca, St. Augustine, and Gall have made in verse and prose the comparison you have made. And yet I can well understand that a father's sufferings may effect great changes in the mind of a son. I will call on you, sir, since you bid me contemplate for the advantage of my pride this terrible spectacle, which must spread so much sorrow throughout your house. It would have done so, unquestionably, had not God given me so large a compensation. In presence of the old man who is dragging his way to the tomb are two children just entering into life. Valentine, the daughter by my first wife, Mademoiselle Renée de Saint-Marin, and Edouard, the boy whose life you have this day saved. And what is your deduction from this compensation, sir? Inquired Monte Cristo. My deduction is, replied Villefort, that my father, led away by his passions, has committed some fault unknown to human justice, but marked by the justice of God. That God, desirous in his mercy to punish but one person, has visited this justice on him alone. Monte Cristo, with a smile on his lips, had yet a groan at his heart, which would have made Villefort fly, had he but heard it. Adieu, sir, said the magistrate, who had risen from his seat. I leave you bearing a remembrance of you, a remembrance of esteem which I hope will not be disagreeable to you when you know me better, for I am not a man to bore my friends, as you will learn. Besides, you have made an eternal friend of Madame de Villefort.
The Count bowed, and contented himself with seeing Villefort to the door of his cabinet, the procureur being escorted to his carriage by two footmen who, on a signal from their master, followed him with every mark of attention. When he had gone, Monte Cristo drew a hard breath from his oppressed bosom, and said, "Enough of this poison. Let me now seek the antidote." Then, sounding his bell, he said to Ali, who entered, "I am going to Madame's chamber. Have the carriage ready at 1 o'clock. 50. A Day. It will be remembered that the new, or rather old, acquaintances of the Count of Monte Cristo residing in the Rue Malay were no other than Maximilian, Julie, and Emmanuel. The very anticipations of delight to be enjoyed in his forthcoming visits, the bright, pure gleam of heavenly happiness it diffused over the almost deadly warfare in which he had voluntarily engaged, illumined his whole countenance with a look of ineffable joy and calmness as, immediately after the departure of Villefort, his thoughts flew back to the cheering prospect before him of tasting at least a brief respite from the fierce and stormy passions of his mind. It was the hour of noon, and Monte Cristo had set apart 1 hour to be passed in the apartments of Ade. As though his so long crushed spirit could not all at once admit the feeling of pure and unmixed joy, but required a gradual succession of calm and gentle emotions to prepare his mind to receive full and perfect happiness, in the same manner as ordinary natures demand to be inured by degrees to the reception of strong or violent sensations. The young Greek, as we have already stated, occupied apartments wholly unconnected with those of the Count. The rooms had been fitted up in strict accordance with the Eastern style, that is to say, the floors were covered with the richest carpets Turkey could produce, the walls hung with brocaded silk of the most magnificent designs and texture, while around each chamber luxurious divans were placed, with piles of soft and yielding cushions that needed only to be arranged at the pleasure or convenience of such as sought repose. Ade's female establishment consisted of 3 French attendants, and a 4th who was, like herself, a native of the climes of Greece. The 3 first remained constantly in a small waiting room, ready to obey the first sound of a small golden bell, or to receive the orders of the Romaic slave, who just knew sufficient French to be enabled to transmit her mistress's orders to the 3 other waiting women, who had received most peremptory instructions from Monte Cristo to treat Ade with all the respect and deference they would observe to a queen. The fair Greek herself generally passed her time in the apartment forming the extremity of the suite of rooms assigned to her. It was a species of boudoir, circular and lighted only from the top, which consisted of pale pink glass. Ade was reclining upon soft downy cushions, covered with blue satin spotted with silver. Her head, supported by one of her exquisitely moulded arms, rested on the divan immediately behind her, while the other was employed in adjusting to her lips the coral tube of a rich narghilé, whose flexible pipe, placed amid the coolest and most fragrant essences, permitted not the perfumed vapour to ascend until fully impregnated with the rich odours of the most delicious flowers. Her attitude, though perfectly natural for an Eastern female, would have been deemed too full of coquettish straining after effect in a European. Her dress, which was that of the women of Epirus, consisted of a pair of white satin trousers embroidered with pink roses, displaying feet so exquisitely formed and so delicately fair that they might well have been taken for Parian marble, had not the eye been undeceived by their constantly shifting in and out of the fairy-like slippers in which they were encased. These tiny coverings were beautifully ornamented with gold and pearls and turned up at the point. A blue and white striped vest with long open sleeves, trimmed with silver loops and buttons of pearls. She also wore a species of bodice which, closing only from the centre to the waist, exhibited the whole of the ivory throat and upper part of the bosom. 3 magnificent diamond clasps fastened it where requisite. The junction of the bodice and drawers was entirely concealed by one of those many-coloured scarfs, whose brilliant hues and rich silken fringe have rendered them so precious in the eyes of Parisian belles. A small cap of gold embroidered with pearls was placed with tasteful elegance on one side of the fair Greek's head, while on the other a natural rose of that dark crimson almost inclining to purple mingled its glowing colours with the luxuriant masses of her hair, which, for jetty lustre, outrivalled the raven's wing. The extreme beauty of the countenance that shone forth in loveliness that mocked the vain attempts of dress to augment it was peculiarly and purely Grecian. There were the large, dark, melting eyes, the finely formed nose, the coral lips and pearly teeth that belonged to her race and country. And to complete the whole, Ade was in the very springtide and fullness of youthful charms. She had not yet numbered more than 18 summers. Upon Monte Cristo entering the apartments of the fair girl, he summoned her Greek attendant and bade her inquire whether it would be agreeable to her mistress to receive his visit. Ade's only reply was to direct her servant by a sign to withdraw the tapestried curtain that hung before the door of her boudoir, the framework of the opening thus made serving as a sort of border to the graceful tableau presented by the picturesque attitude and appearance of Ade. As Monte Cristo approached, she leaned upon the elbow of the arm that held the nargola, and, extending to him her other hand, said with a smile of captivating sweetness in the sonorous language spoken by the females of Athens and Sparta, "Why demand permission ere you enter? Are you no longer my master, or have I ceased to be your slave?" Monte Cristo returned his smile. "Ade," said he, "you well know."
"Why do you address me so coldly, so distantly?" asked the fair Greek. "Have I by any means displeased you? Oh, if so, punish me as you will. But do not speak to me in tones of manner so formal and constrained."
"Listen to me, Ade," replied the Count. "I was about to remind you of a circumstance you are perfectly acquainted with, namely, that we are now in France, and that you are consequently free."
"Free?"
repeated the fair girl. "Of what use would freedom be to me? It would enable you to quit me."
"Quit you? Wherefore should I do so?"
"That is not for me to say. But we are now about to mix in society, to visit and be visited.
I desire to see no one but yourself."
"Nay, but hear me, Ade. You cannot remain in seclusion in the midst of this gay capital. And should you see one whom you could prefer, think not I would be so selfish or unjust as to..."
"No, no,"
answered Ade, with energetic warmth.
"That can never be. No man could appear charming in my eyes but yourself. None save yourself and my father have ever possessed my affection, nor will it be bestowed upon any other."
"My poor child," replied Monte Cristo, "that is merely because your father and myself are the only men with whom you have ever conversed. And what care I for all others in the world? My father called me his joy. You style me your love. And both of you bestowed on me the endearing appellation of your child." "Do you remember your father, Ade?" The young Greek smiled.
"He is here and here," said she, touching her eyes and her heart.
"And where am I?" inquired Monte Cristo laughingly.
"You," cried she with tones of thrilling tenderness, "you are everywhere."
Monte Cristo took the delicate hand of the young girl in his, and was about to raise it to his lips, when the simple child of nature hastily withdrew it and presented her fair cheek instead.
"You now understand, Ade," said the Count, "that from this moment you are absolutely free, that here you exercise unlimited sway, and are at liberty to lay aside or continue the costume of your country as it may suit your inclination. Within this mansion you are absolute mistress of your actions, and may go abroad or remain in your apartments as may seem most agreeable to you. A carriage waits your orders, and Ali and Murta will accompany you whithersoever you desire to go. There is but one favor I would entreat of you."
"Oh, speak!"
"Preserve most carefully the secret of your birth. Make no allusion to the past, nor upon any occasion be induced to pronounce the names of your illustrious father or ill-fated mother."
"I have already told my lord it is not my intention to hold converse with anyone save himself."
"It is possible, Ade, that so perfect a seclusion, though conformable with the habits and customs of the East, may not be practicable in Paris. Endeavour, then, to accustom yourself to our manner of living in these northern climes, as you did to those of Rome, Florence, Milan, and Madrid. It may be useful to you one of these days whether you remain here or return to the East."
The fair girl raised her tearful eyes towards Monte Cristo as she said with touching earnestness,
my lord would mean whether we return to the east or continue here, would he not?
My child, returned Monte Cristo, you know full well that whenever we part it will be by no fault or wish of mine. The tree forsakes not the blossom that embellishes it. It is the flower that falls from the tree on which it grew.
My lord, replied Ede, never will I quit you, for sure I am I could not exist if banished your presence. Alas, what would life be worth then?
My poor girl, you forget that 10 years will effect an essentially different change in both of us. To you that space of time will bring but the perfection of womanly graces, while it will wrinkle my brows and change my hair to grey.
My father had numbered 60 years, and the snows of age were on his head, but I admired and loved him far better than all the gay, handsome youths I saw about his court.
Then tell me, Ede, do you believe you shall be able to accustom yourself to our present mode of life?
Shall I see you?
Every day.
Then what does my lord apprehend for me?
I fear you're growing weary.
Nay, my lord, that cannot be. In the morning I shall rejoice in the prospect of your coming, and in the evening dwell with delight on the happiness I have enjoyed in your presence. Oh, believe me, that when 3 great passions, such as sorrow, love, and gratitude, fill the heart, ennui can find no place.
You are a worthy daughter of Epirus, Ede, and your charming and poetical ideas prove well your descent from that race of goddesses who claim your country as their birthplace. Depend on my care to see that your youth is not blighted or suffered to pass away in ungenial solitude. And of this be well assured, that if you love me as a father, I in my turn feel for you all the affection of the fondest parent.
Let not my lord be deceived. The love I bear you resembles in no degree my feelings towards my father. I survived his death, but were any evil to befall you, the moment in which I learned the fatal tidings would be the last of my life.
The Count, with a look of indescribable tenderness, extended his hand to the animated speaker, who carried it reverentially and affectionately to her lips. The carriage was prepared according to orders, and stepping lightly into it, the Count drove off at his usual rapid pace.
51. The Morel Family. In a very few minutes the Count reached No. 7 in the Rue Mellet. The house was of white stone, and in a small court before it were 2 small beds full of beautiful flowers. In the concierge that opened the gate the Count recognized Cocles. But as he had but one eye, and that eye had considerably weakened in the course of 9 years, Cocles did not so readily recognize the Count. The carriages that drove up to the door were compelled to turn to avoid a fountain that played in a basin of rockwork, in which sported a quantity of gold and silver fishes, an ornament that had excited the jealousy of the whole quarter, and had gained for the house the appellation of Le Petit Versailles. The house, raised above the kitchens and cellars, had, besides the ground floor, 2 stories and attics. The whole of the property, consisting of an immense workshop, 2 pavilions at the bottom of the garden and the garden itself, had been purchased by Emmanuel, who had seen at a glance that he could make a profitable speculation of it. He had reserved the house and half the garden, and building a wall between the garden and the workshops, had let them upon lease, with the pavilions at the bottom of the garden, so that for a trifling sum he was as well lodged and as perfectly shut out from observation as the inhabitant of the finest hotel in the Faubourg Saint-Germain. The breakfast room was of oak, the salon of mahogany and blue velvet, the bedroom of citron wood and green damask. There was a study for Emmanuel, who never studied, and a music room for Julie, who never played. The whole of the 2nd story was set apart for Maximilian. It was precisely the same as his sister's apartments, except that the breakfast parlour was changed into a billiard room where he received his friends. He was superintending the dressing of his horse and smoking his cigar at the entrance to the garden when the Count's carriage stopped at the door. Cocles opened the gate, and Battistin, springing from the box, inquired whether Monsieur and Madame Urbeau and Monsieur Maximilien Morel would see Monsieur le Comte de Monte Cristo.
"Monsieur le Comte de Monte Cristo," cried Morel, throwing away his cigar and hastening to the carriage. "I should think we would see him. Ah, a thousand thanks, Monsieur le Comte, for not having forgotten your promise." And the young officer shook the Count's hand so warmly that the latter could not be mistaken as to the sincerity of his joy, and he saw that he had been expected with impatience and was received with pleasure. "Come, come," said Maximilian, "I will serve as your guide. Such a man as you are ought not to be introduced by a servant. My sister is in the garden plucking the dead roses, my brother reading his two papers, La Presse and Les Debats, within 5 steps of her, for wherever you see Madame Urbeau, you have only to look within a circle of 4 yards, and you will find Monsieur Emmanuel, and reciprocally, as they say, at the École Polytechnique." At the sound of their steps, a young woman of 20 to 25, dressed in a silk robe de chambre and busily engaged plucking the dead leaves off a splendid rose tree, raised her head. This female was Julie, who had become, as the clerk of the house of Thompson and French had predicted, Madame Emmanuel Urbeau. She uttered a cry of surprise at the sight of a stranger, and Maximilian began to laugh. "Don't disturb yourself, Julie," said he. "Monsieur le Comte has only been 2 or 3 days in Paris, but he already knows what a woman of fashion of the Marais is, and if he does not, you will show him." "Ah, monsieur," returned Julie, "it is treason in my brother to bring you thus, but he never has any regard for his poor sister. Penelon, Penelon." An old man, who was digging busily at one of the beds of roses, stuck his spade in the earth and approached, cap in hand, and striving to conceal a quid of tobacco he had just thrust into his cheek. A few locks of grey mingled with his hair, which was still thick and matted, whilst his bronzed features and determined glance announced the old sailor who had braved the heat of the equator and the storms of the tropics. "I think you hailed me, Mademoiselle Julie," said he. Penelon had still preserved the habit of calling his master's daughter Mademoiselle Julie, and had never been able to change the name to Madame Urbeau. "Penelon," replied Julie, "go and inform Monsieur Emmanuel of this gentleman's visit, and Maximilian will conduct him to the salon." Then, turning to Monte Cristo, "I hope you will permit me to leave you for a few minutes," continued she, and without awaiting any reply, disappeared behind a clump of trees and entered the house by a lateral alley. "I am sorry to see," observed Monte Cristo to Morel, "that I cause no small disturbance in your house." "Look there," said Maximilian, laughing. "There is her husband changing his jacket for a coat. I assure you, you are well known in the Rue Mellet. Your family appears to me a very happy one," said the Count, as if speaking to himself. "Oh, yes, I assure you, Monsieur le Comte, they want nothing that can render them happy. They are young and cheerful. They are tenderly attached to each other, and with 25,000 francs a year, they fancy themselves as rich as Rothschild." 25,000 francs is not a large sum, however," replied Monte Cristo, with a tone so sweet and gentle that it went to Maximilian's heart like the voice of a father. "But they will not be content with that. Your brother-in-law is a barrister, a doctor. He was a merchant, Monsieur le Comte, and had succeeded to the business of my poor father. Monsieur Morel, at his death, left 500,000 francs, £20,000, which were divided between my sister and myself, for we were his only children. Her husband, who, when he married her, had no other patrimony than his noble probity, his first-rate ability, and his spotless reputation, wished to possess as much as his wife. He labored and toiled until he had amassed 250,000 francs. 6 years sufficed to achieve this object. Oh, I assure you, Monsieur le Comte, it was a touching spectacle to see these young creatures, destined by their talents for higher stations, toiling together, and who, unwilling to change any of the customs of their paternal house, took 6 years to accomplish that which innovators would have effected in 2 or 3. Marseille resounded with their well-earned praises. At last, one day, Emmanuel came to his wife, who had just finished making up the accounts. "Julie," said he to her, "Cocles has just given me the last rouleau of 100 francs. That completes the 250,000 francs we had fixed as the limits of our gains. Can you content yourself with the small fortune which we shall possess for the future? Listen to me. Our house transacts business to the amount of 1 million a year, from which we derive an income of 40,000 francs. We can dispose of the business, if we please, in an hour, for I have received a letter from Monsieur Delaunay in which he offers to purchase the goodwill of the house, to unite with his own, for 300,000 francs. Advise me what I had better do.
Emmanuel, returned my sister, the house of Morel can only be carried on by a Morel. Is it not worth 300,000 francs to save our father's name from the chances of evil fortune and failure?
I thought so, replied Emmanuel, but I wish to have your advice. This is my counsel. Our accounts are made up and our bills paid. All we have to do is to stop the issue of any more and close our office. This was done instantly. It was 3 o'clock. At 15:15, a merchant presented himself to insure 2 ships. It was a clear profit of 15,000 francs.
Monsieur, said Emmanuel, have the goodness to address yourself to Monsieur Delaunay. We have quitted business.
How long? Inquired the astonished merchant. 15 minutes, was the reply. And this is the reason, Monsieur, continued Maximilian, of my sister and brother-in-law having only 25,000 francs a year.
Maximilian had scarcely finished his story, during which the Count's heart had seemed ready to burst, when Emmanuel entered, clad in a hat and coat. He saluted the Count with the air of a man who is aware of the rank of his guest. Then, after having led Monte Cristo round the little garden, he returned to the house. A large vase of Japan porcelain filled with flowers that impregnated the air with their perfume stood in the salon. Julie, suitably dressed and her hair arranged, she had accomplished this feat in less than 10 minutes, received the Count on his entrance. The songs of the birds were heard in an aviary hard by, the branches of false ebony trees and rose acacias forming the border of the blue velvet curtains. Everything in this charming retreat, from the warble of the birds to the smile of the mistress, breathed tranquillity and repose. The Count had felt, from the moment he entered the house, the influence of this happiness, and he remained silent and pensive, forgetting that he was expected to recommence the conversation which had ceased after the first salutations had been exchanged. He perceived the pause, and, by a violent effort, tearing himself from his pleasing reverie, "Madame," said he at length, "I pray you to excuse my emotion, which must astonish you who are only accustomed to the happiness I meet here. But satisfaction is so new a sight to me that I could never be weary of looking at yourself and your husband."
"We are very happy, monsieur," replied Julie, "but we have also known unhappiness, and few have ever undergone more bitter sufferings than ourselves."
The Count's features displayed an expression of the most intense curiosity.
"Oh, all this is family history, as Chateau Renaud told you the other day," observed Maximilian. "This humble picture would have but little interest for you, accustomed as you are to behold the pleasures and the misfortunes of the wealthy and illustrious. But such as we are, we have experienced bitter sorrows. And God has poured balm into your wounds, as he does to all those who are in affliction?" said Monte Cristo inquiringly.
"Yes, Monsieur le Comte," returned Julie, "we may indeed say he has, for he has done for us what he grants only to his chosen. He sent us one of his angels."
The Count's cheeks became scarlet, and he coughed in order to have an excuse for putting his handkerchief to his mouth. "Those born to wealth, and who have the means of gratifying every wish," said Emmanuel, "know not what is the real happiness of life. Just as those who have been tossed on the stormy waters of the ocean on a few frail planks can alone estimate the value of a clear and serene sky." Monte Cristo rose, and without making any answer, for the tremulousness of his voice would have betrayed his emotion, walked up and down the apartment with a slow step.
"Our magnificence makes you smile, Monsieur le Comte," said Maximilian, who had followed him with his eyes.
"No, no," returned Monte Cristo, pale as death, pressing one hand on his heart to still its throbbings, whilst with the other he pointed to a crystal cover, beneath which a silken purse lay on a black velvet cushion.
"I was wondering,
What could be the use of this purse, which contains a paper at one end and, at the other, a large diamond?
Monsieur le Comte, replied Maximilien with an air of gravity, those are our most precious family treasures.
The stone seems very brilliant, answered the Count. Oh, my brother does not allude to its value, although it has been estimated at 100,000 francs, £4,000. He means that the articles contained in this purse are the relics of the angel I spoke of just now.
This I do not comprehend, and yet I may not ask for an explanation, madame, replied Monte Cristo, bowing. Pardon me, I had no intention of committing an indiscretion.
Indiscretion? Oh, you make us happy by giving us an occasion of expatiating on this subject. Did we intend to conceal the noble action this purse commemorates, we should not expose it thus.
Oh, would we could relate it everywhere and to everyone, so that the emotion of our unknown benefactor might reveal his presence.
Ah, really, said Monte Cristo in a half-stifled voice.
Monsieur, returned Maximilian, raising the glass cover and respectfully kissing the silken purse, this has touched the hand of a man who saved my father from suicide, us from ruin, and our name from shame and disgrace. A man by whose matchless benevolence we, poor children, doomed to wanton wretchedness, can at present hear everyone envying our happy lot. This letter, as he spoke, Maximilian drew a letter from the purse and gave it to the Count. This letter was written by him the day that my father had taken a desperate resolution, and this diamond was given by the generous unknown to my sister as her dowry.
Monte Cristo opened the letter and read it with an indescribable feeling of delight. It was the letter written, as our readers know, to Julie and signed Sinbad the Sailor.
Unknown, you say, is the man who rendered you this service. Unknown to you?
Yes, we have never had the happiness of pressing his hand, continued Maximilian. We have supplicated heaven in vain to grant us this favor, but all the affair has had a mysterious direction we cannot comprehend. All has been guided by a hand invisible, but powerful as that of an enchanter.
Oh, cried Julie, I have not lost all hope of some day kissing that hand, as I now kiss the purse which he has touched.
4 years ago, Penelon was at Trieste. Penelon, Monsieur le Comte, is the old sailor you saw in the garden, and who, from quartermaster, has become gardener. Penelon, when he was at Trieste, saw on the quay an Englishman who was on the point of embarking on board a yacht, and he recognized him as the person who called on my father the 5th of June, 1829, and who wrote me this letter the 5th of September. He felt quite convinced of his identity, but he did not venture to address him.
An Englishman, said Monte Cristo, who grew uneasy at the attention with which Julie looked at him.
An Englishman, you say?
Yes, replied Maximilian. An Englishman who represented himself as the confidential clerk of the House of Thompson and French at Rome. It was this that made me start when you said the other day at Monsieur de Morcerf's that Messrs. Thompson and French were your bankers. That happened, as I told you, in 1829. For God's sake, tell me, did you know this Englishman?
But you tell me also that the House of Thompson and French have constantly denied having rendered you this service.
Yes.
Then is it not probable that this Englishman may be someone who, grateful for a kindness your father had shown him and which he himself had forgotten, has taken this method of requiting the obligation?
Everything is possible on such an occasion, even a miracle.
What was his name? Asked Monte Cristo.
He gave no other name, answered Julie, looking earnestly at the Count, than that at the end of his letter, Sinbad the Sailor,
which is evidently not his real name, but a fictitious one.
Then noticing that Julie was struck with the sound of his voice, tell me, continued he, was he not about my height, perhaps a little taller, his chin imprisoned, to use the word, in a high cravat, his coat closely buttoned up and constantly taking out his pencil?
Oh, do you then know him? Cried Julie, whose eyes sparkled with joy.
No, returned Monte Cristo, I only guessed.
I knew a Lord Wilmore who was constantly doing actions of this kind. Without revealing himself, he was an eccentric being, and did not believe in the existence of gratitude. Oh, heaven! Exclaimed Julie, clasping her hands. In what did he believe, then? He did not credit it at the period when I knew him, said Monte Cristo, touched to the heart by the accent of Julie's voice. But perhaps since then he has had proofs that gratitude does exist.
And do you know this gentleman, monsieur? Inquired Emmanuel,